This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.
It really is a privilege to be invited to speak here at Cambridge. And I must thank the organisers for giving me the opportunity to share the story of our company, GEMS Education. It is always with a great sense of pride that I tell everyone that I meet that I represent the third generation of an education family. Three of my grandparents were teachers. In 1959, my paternal grandparents emigrated from the south of India to Dubai to make a better life for themselves and their family. They were educated, but life in India at that time, when you're from a lower middle class family, really there was little opportunity. Theirs was a story of courage and aspiration. And I, standing here in front of you today, am very grateful that they had the strength to make that journey. Perhaps the story of my family to some extent exemplifies the profound impact of receiving a quality education. As a consequence, for the last 55 years, we've been driven by a very singular purpose: to try and put a quality education within the reach of every child and every student. And today, this purpose has brought us to a point where, through our schools, through the work that we undertake on behalf of governments around the world, and through our subsidiaries, we have the privilege of educating over 250,000 students each and every day. And this is across 19 countries, and these students represent 171 different nationalities. We also have the privilege of employing almost 20,000 education professionals and staff from 115 different countries. And finally, through the work of our foundation, for every child that attends a GEM school, we seek and strive to positively impact the lives of 100 children that today cannot access a quality education. As a result, today we are the largest K-12 education company in the world. But most importantly, we believe passionately that solving the education crisis globally represents the single greatest opportunity to improve the state of our world. However, it's important to understand the context. Depending on the numbers that one chooses to look at, the education gap globally is defined by universal access to basic primary education, or Millennium Development Goal 2. And while there has been some movement towards improving that, today, that number stands at approximately 57 million young people that today cannot access even a basic primary education. And we all know that we won't meet this goal for 2015. But what if we extend that definition and look at those children that have been forced to opt out of secondary school? You add another 72 million to that 57 million. What about children who may be sitting in a classroom but the teacher is absent, forcing school administrators to put together class sizes that are 70, 80, or 100 just so that there is a teacher standing in front of those kids? What if we were to extend our definition beyond just children and look at the 793 million young people that are illiterate, mostly women and girls? Combine this, I am building a picture here, by the way, combine this with the sheer weight of demand driven by accelerating population growth dynamics in emerging markets. And as an example, let's just look at the BRIC nations. Just to keep pace with incremental population growth, you would need to add every year 10,000 schools. And this doesn't take into account existing capacity shortage in a place like India, which is today short of 200,000 schools. If we start to look at all of these factors and think about defining the education gap as not just about universal access to education, but universal access to a minimum standard or quality of education, then the gap that we may be looking at extends to well over 1 billion young people. And by the way, this number is accelerating away from us. Governments on their own cannot move fast enough to meet this demand. Governments on their own cannot fund this demand. In the face of such a requirement, increasingly, it becomes apparent that either private sector will step in outright, or in partnership with governments and NGOs, in order to provide the quality of education that communities around the world increasingly desire at the speed that communities around the world truly need. In the face of such a challenge, we don't have the time to engage in the traditional intellectual and political debates of public versus private that seem to occupy so much time and resource here in the developed world. In every other walk of life, we've adopted private sector principles. In fact, we now find ourselves living in a time where even the most successful NGOs and foundations adopt private sector principles in trying to fulfill their humanitarian missions. And yet, when private sector is mentioned in the context of education, there is still a stigma attached to it. We believe it's because of residual anxiety. The fear that somehow private players will only serve the needs of the rich, or simply widen the gap between the rich and the poor. However, our belief is that if applied correctly, adopting private sector principles in education allow us to create schools and education systems that are sustainable, who are self-sufficient, and whose financial viability provide the freedom and the capacity to build an education system at scale and at place. This is how we can truly help deliver an international education. The most common misconception regarding private education is that it is the domain of the wealthy. Many even class them as elitist. However, here is the interesting fact that about education, certainly about private education, that may seem counterintuitive to many people. The most mature private sector education markets are actually found in emerging countries. And it is actually the developed markets that have the most immature private sector education markets. Fundamentally, this is explained by the fact that developed nations have historically had relatively accessible social welfare systems, such as a public education system, underperforming, though many may be around the world. Whereas in emerging nations, this has not been the case. So in a scenario where the average person does not have access to a public education system, the private sector has stepped in to create an education solution for that person and their children. In fact, in our home market of Dubai and the UAE, almost 90% of education is provided by the private sector. It is today the largest and fastest growing private K-12 market in the world, having experienced growth in private school student enrollment of 7.1%, 8.7%, and 10% in the last 3 years alone. It is a market where a parent has the freedom and the flexibility to choose a school that charges as little as £700 a year in tuition to schools that charge £30,000 a year in tuition. In addition, those families and those parents can choose from over 15 different curricula, depending on the ambition and the aspiration that they have for the future of their children. However, this is only one example. If one looks at the work undertaken by James Tooley, who has historically been one of the foremost proponents of privatization education, he has actually found examples of private schools in parts of India where education is provided for as little as $3 a month. This is, of course, one extreme, and quality of education can be debated, but it still beats the alternative, which is nothing. In fact, if one analyzes emerging countries, you see a much more segmented education market that offers parents flexibility, choice, rather than the typical private schools that we tend to see here in the West, which are expensive and typically inaccessible for the vast majority of people. In countries like Pakistan, India, and across Africa, there has been significant expansion in non-state places. In Pakistan, for example, the share of private sector education has increased from approximately 3% in 1980 to approximately 25 and 30% today. India's annual Status for Education report showed that private school enrollment increased from 16.3% in 2005 to 22.6% in 2008, which is an increase of 40% in a short space of time. And we know that the demand for private sector education is increasing worldwide. According to the IFC, in Ghana, Kenya, Nigeria, Senegal, and Uganda, private school enrollment is up to over 40%. This education is delivered in the main through low-cost and low-cost fee schools. It is truly astonishing to see how poor families are prepared to make considerable sacrifices to send their children to non-state schools. However, there is always a caveat. The education sector globally needs to be seen as the building of critical infrastructure that will ultimately secure the future of a nation. Consequently, like all infrastructure, in order to be successful, the education sector needs to attract capital and investors that are truly long-term. This is fundamental to building an international education that students all over the world can truly access. Unfortunately, the majority of the capital that is finding its way into the education space is still fundamentally short-term. However, we do see this trend shifting, albeit slowly. It's important, I suppose, for me to articulate now what I consider to be the potential efficiencies of a private education or private sector provision of education. If we talk about standards and efficiency, for the same per pupil cost, how much more achievement would one get in private than in public schools? Based on a World Bank study of achievement in language and mathematics in Colombia, the Dominican Republic, the Philippines, Tanzania, and Thailand, the answer ranged from as little as 1.2 times in the Philippines to as much as 6.74 times in Thailand in terms of private sector achievement over public schools. I personally am fortunate to have experienced schools in our network where parents pay £1,500 a year in tuition, where the children are outperforming the relevant national average by over 30 percentage points. The interesting fact here is that in this particular country, the country spends an average of £8,000 to £10,000 per pupil. It's also worth talking about equity. There are private providers of education today around the world, such as ourselves, that are able to deliver consistent educational outcomes regardless of the tuition fees being paid by parents. In our case, we're able to send a child from a £700 a year school, a year school to MIT, just as we would a child from a school that charges £30,000 a year. In fact, this is the reason why people like UNESCO chose us to be their first ever private K-12 education partner, why we're the K-12 industry leader for the World Economic Forum, why world leaders, no longer burdened by the shackles of politics, refer to us as a model of success. How have we been able to achieve this? The simple answer is accountability. Simple private sector fundamentals ensure that there is a strong chain of accountability amongst all of the key stakeholders. Parents, because they pay no matter how little, have made an active choice to ensure their children's future, and by nature are more engaged in their children's education. Students come into the school engaged and motivated to learn because their parents have impressed upon them the value of a good education. For providers and investors, a competitive market or in a competitive market, success ensures survival. Providers and investors are accountable to parents as paying customers. In order for a school to be successful, viable, and sustainable, it must be full. If the school is not producing results, parents typically vote with their feet and withdraw their children and put them into competitor schools. Teachers, given the pressure on the school to produce results, teachers are held to incredibly high standards of accountability by providers, investors, and their parents. If teachers fail to meet the high standards, of course we help them improve. But if that is not successful, we also manage their exit. But this is done at speed so as not to jeopardize the learning outcomes in the future of our students. Therefore, in order to imagine a world where a right to a quality education becomes reality, we truly need to consider new solutions and new approaches. We must see changes in government policy. where private education providers entering a new country with an innovative new model is actually welcomed and supported rather than the typical negative or disincentivizing policy response that we still see today, usually driven by short-term political considerations. There are great examples today, all around the world, that look to harness the power of collaboration between a socially conscious private sector, governments with foresight, and robust NGOs. It is critical that we leverage these sustainable partnerships to create solutions that will maximize the benefits to the poorest schools and the poorest communities in the world. And so let me end with a story that hopefully highlights one such example. At the very first advisory board meeting for our foundation, we presented a plan to train 50,000 teachers through our low-cost teacher training program. Because in this endeavor, we believe that teachers matter most. At that meeting, as you would expect him to, President Clinton, who is the honorary chairman of our foundation, challenged us to do more. And so we extended that commitment and committed to training 250,000 teachers. Just last year, we trained over 7,000 teachers in Uganda. Independently verified, this program has impacted the lives of over 365,000 students. The next phase of the teacher training program will be delivered in Ghana, thanks to the support of our partners at Dubai Cares. If we're successful in training 250,000 teachers, we will have created the conditions that will improve the lives of over 10 million children. It will take time. But if we get it right, can you imagine what we can achieve? Thank you.
This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.